Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Drones equipped with facial recognition, bioweapons customized to one person's DNA. How scary is the future of war? Let's get to the bottom line. When we think of war, most probably it's based on the images we see from Ukraine's battlefields. Tanks, soldiers, guns, planes, and bombs. But that's just what we see with our own eyes. And the Ukraine war has mostly been a conventional war, at least thus far. It's more like the combat of the last century. But if you look just around the corner, you'll find a whole alarming world out there. And it's not science fiction. We're talking about assassination drones programmed to roam around to find and kill a specific person. How about personalized bioweapons? Yes, you heard it correctly. A virus that is targeted to work on the DNA of one person. We saw that in the last James Bond film, but I'm not going to spoil the ending for you. And on top of that, we have major advances in information operations, cyber attacks, and even data breaches where our personal information is used against us. So what will the wars of the 21st century look like? Today, we're talking with Mark Goodman, a global strategist who's worked with the FBI and Interpol and founded the Future Crimes Institute at Silicon Valley's Singularity University. He is the author of Future Crimes: Inside the Digital Underground and the Battle for Our Connected World. Mark Goodman, it's terrific to be with you. And I need to tell our audience that this is a conversation you and I have been having literally for more than a decade. And I want to put something up on the screen for our audience from something you wrote in The Atlantic a decade ago. And in it, it's called Hacking, the article is called Hacking the President's DNA. I'd love our audience to get a feel for you, what you feel are the greatest fragilities right now as we look forward to technological advancement. But how can these be turned around in very disconcerting ways?
Well, thank you, Steve, for having me on your show. It's great to reconnect again. In terms of your question, technology has always decided battles throughout history. The people who had the most ships, the people who had the best muskets, the people who had access to explosives and eventually chemical and now biological weapons and even nuclear weapons. So technology is at the forefront of warfare. What's changing, though, is the amount of money you need to develop these weapons and the proliferations of technology. So you mentioned biowarfare, biotechnology, bioweapons, as I covered in my Atlantic article on hacking the president's DNA. But in fact, every technology, and in terms of modern exponential technologies, think of robotics, artificial intelligence, machine learning, nanotechnology, genetic synthetic biology, Internet of Things. Every single one of these devices can be used for a public good, but there's always the flip side of technology, and that they can be used by criminals, by state actors, and of course by terrorist organizations. And as the price and proliferation of these technologies decreases, the proliferation increases and the price decreases, there's a growing range of non-state actors that can also get access to these tools.
You know, one of the things I've thought about a bit as we've seen poisonings now used as an act of state and, you know, to some degree terror. And we've seen accusations that Russia's President Vladimir Putin has poisoned and killed both with radioactive elements and, you know, other pathogens to do this. I guess my question to you, Mark, is are we at the point where the vision you had 10 years ago is really here, that we've caught up with that vision and today we really do run the risk of an individual pathogen or a pathogen that's directed, you know, at a group of, you know, people with a certain characteristic? And what does that mean?
Well, I think that we are definitely there. You mentioned President Putin and some of his activities. We've definitely seen it in terms of the chemical attacks with Novichok against Mr. Skripal, the former Russian officer in the UK. That caused quite a chemical attack on the people of the United Kingdom, of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. We saw it more recently with opposition leader Navalny, where they put a chemical weapon in his underwear that ended up sending him to the hospital in Germany and almost killed him. So countries in general, and Russia and in specific, have been very aggressive about using these tools. And the same things that you can do with personalized chemical weapons, you can certainly do with personalized genetic weapons. At the time the first human genome was decoded nearly two decades ago, The cost of doing that was $3 billion and took over a decade with a global and international effort to pull it off. Today, you can do the same thing in a matter of hours or days for about $100. So Moore's Law has held consistent throughout this whole process. And in fact, advances in synthetic biology and genetics are proceeding at a pace five times as rapidly as Moore's Law. And what that means is that our abilities to use synthetic biology and genetics for both good and ill is proceeding at an exponential pace.
So it's kind of, you know, in a way, a genetic arms race that I'm hearing from you. And I guess my question is, who's best at this game? Where are we? Where is the United States vis-a-vis Russia, China, Iran, I don't know, France, England, other nations that look, you know, all warm and cuddly, but may in fact have capacities that we should be worried about?
Yeah, it's a simple answer to your question because it's indisputable. The world leader on this front is the People's Republic of China. Mm-hmm. They have the greatest number of personnel dedicated to this effort, the greatest budgets dedicated to this effort, and they have something called the Beijing Genomics Institute, or BGI, which is the largest genomic sequencing company in the world. I say company because, in effect, it is a public entity, but it was created with the help and sponsorship of the People's Liberation Army. And so as citizens around the world, not just Chinese citizens, but as citizens around the world submit DNA for medical tests or other purposes, huge amounts of it are being sent off to China without the knowledge, understanding, or tacit agreement or informed consent of the people who do it. I can give you two examples. One was there is a test that can be given to pregnant women for genetic defects. And it was discovered that over 8 million women around the world from 52 different countries had agreed to get this genetic test to see if their baby was going to have a medical issue. What they did not know is that all 8 million samples were sent off to BGI in Beijing because it could be processed there more quickly. BGI shared all of that information with the People's Liberation Army, did joint studies on it, built up a huge bio data bank, and have now gone ahead and published numerous papers on it. I'll say that was just one example. One thing that is growing increasingly common, both in the United States, Europe, and other parts of the world, is the concept of genetic testing. People want to be tested both for medical issues to see if they have an underlying medical issue, and also for purposes of ancestry. And two of the largest companies that partake in these tests around the world, both 23andMe and Ancestry.com, have also used genetic sequencers in China to help use this information. And so there are some risks there that are not widely understood by the general public. And in fact, the concern is so great that the military has issued a warning to all service members in the United States, strongly discouraging them from using companies like 23andMe and Ancestry until they can get greater clarity on what specifically is being done with their genetic material when they submit it.
That's a fascinating rabbit hole to go down. But let me ask you something about the U.S. side of this. You've talked a little bit about China being the leader in potentially weaponizing, you know, some of this DNA information. There's a remarkable cable that we all came to see as a result of Edward Snowden's revelations. And obviously, Edward Snowden is a complicated character out there. But nonetheless, we have him to thank for this top secret cable. In July 31st of 2009, and it is the reporting and collection needs at the United Nations issued by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And basically, she instructs her team to collect biographical and biometric information on key permanent representatives to the UN. I mean, are we part of the arms race in the United States? Because this memo basically says we probably are.
Yeah, to your point, the U.S. definitely is a player in this field. Let's remember that it was the United States that decoded the first human genome, and we have some of the best genomic scientists in the world There are many people out there like George Church and many others that are absolutely at the cutting edge of this type of research science. And the U.S., of course, is looking at the military implications of these tools, if for no other reason but to be able to protect its soldiers if some other country were to develop a bioweapon that could negatively impact U.S. soldiers posted abroad, U.S. diplomats posted abroad, or even the broader U.S. citizenry, the United States government would be derelict in its duties if it did not understand the implications and the consequences. And though it may seem far-fetched to think that somebody would launch a biological attack against the United States, we thought 10 years ago it would be improbable, if not impossible, for somebody to launch a nuclear weapon or a tactical nuclear weapon in the 21st century. And yet here we find those issues very much up for debate and potentially to be put into effect by Russia in Ukraine and elsewhere. So warfare is tricky and it's changing all the time. So yes, the U.S. is definitely researching this. Clearly, if they put out that cable, and I don't, you know, I've never seen the cable, it's classified, so I don't know what is said in it, except to say that I know it was part of the release of information out there. And you could understand that if you are the U.S. government or any government, you want to learn as much about your friends and even your enemies as you can, because if you're negotiating with a foreign leader and there is genetic suggestions that they are mentally ill, have a short life, will have a short life, will have some sort of critical disease, that may very well play into your foreign policy or how you approach the leader. The one thing I will say about the United States versus China, for example, is that here we are not required to provide genetic information to the government upon our birth. But that is true in many countries around the world. Denmark, 30 years ago, instituted a genetic biobank, and they did it for the purposes of curing disease. But now, 20, 25 years later, some of those infants have grown up, and that same genetic database can be used by the government of Denmark and has been for the purposes of identifying criminals. The last thing I'll say about China is that it is an order of magnitude larger in terms of its databases, with 1.3 billion citizens all required to submit genetic material. They have a huge advantage. On the positive side, they have a huge advantage for the purposes of developing medicines and uncovering diseases, because we've now entered the age where you can mix not just genetic information, but artificial intelligence and machine learning to uncover traits and patterns that otherwise would have been previously impossible due to computational limitations. So they have that benefit. And of course, if they can do it for the purposes of good, they also can do it for the purposes of ill, including warfare.
What we're seeing in warfare and hybrid war is not only the manipulation of our physical being, of our genetics, of our DNA, of the creation potentially of viruses, but the influence on our minds, the taking of data, the compromising across a lot of fronts in the, you know, I guess you'd call it the digital and, you know, cyberspace. And, you know, one of the things that's been interesting is the cybersecurity chief at Twitter, the former cybersecurity chief, now a whistleblower, has said there's just a recklessness in the way that massive amounts of data, personal data about people, is being used. This person alleges that there are many spies for India employed within Twitter. We've had Saudi individuals who previously worked for Twitter who were, in fact, convicted of spying for Saudi Arabia. I guess my question is, should we, any of us, sleep well at night given this vulnerability? I mean, I always sort of see society as the responsibility of society, of a government, is to create safer and safer and better environments. But as I look at what's going on, I just sort of fear that so many of the areas that we've taken for granted as being safe are in fact wobbly, fragile, and they create vulnerabilities for us. So I'd just be interested in how you see our data world, and you know, you just talked about 23andMe, but what about Twitter, Facebook, Google, other major social media platforms?
Well, I share your concern, and I think it's very astute that you pointed out. And when I try to share my concerns about all the social media companies from Instagram, let alone TikTok, which has, again, staff and founders from the Chinese People's Liberation Army that helped found TikTok and ByteDance. So it's all out there, but a lot of people say, well, who cares if Facebook has my data in? Who cares if Facebook has over a billion people on their platform? They're just a company. What do I care? But what people don't realize is that as soon as one organization collects it, other organizations will get it. They will get it because they pay for it, right? Law enforcement in the United States, for one, certainly can buy streams of social media data that can be shared with the government. There are governments that hack that data, and we've seen dozens and dozens examples of that. And then again, we have hidden players, either organized criminals or espionage actors from foreign nations that are placed within these organizations. And the challenge is, as I'm sure you know, and you know, The Economist is writing about this 20 years ago, data is the new oil. So the more and more data we produce, the more and more data that you have, the greater your wealth, the greater your military prowess, your intelligence prowess, and of course, your economic prowess. So who owns this data and what is done with it should definitely be up to subject to debate. I will say that certain governments do a much better job of protecting this data than others. I'm thinking specifically of the European Union has a number of general regulations on data privacy and the like, as do many other nations. Most other countries, with the exception of the United States, have a national data commissioner that looks after these things. So you're absolutely right to look at it, and I'll just be a bit future-oriented out there and say, as much data as we have collected now, it is minuscule in terms of what we will be collecting going forward with things like the Internet of Things and the metaverse that Facebook is now very much getting involved in. In fact, when it comes to the growth of the Internet and the collection and processing of data manually, but mostly through machine learning and artificial intelligence, we are but in the first seconds of the first minutes of the first hours of the internet revolution. And frankly, none of us knows what's going to come next. So it is both a very exciting possible time to be alive in, but it is also quite concerning as well.
So my question to you is there any way to control these technologies that can be used both for good and for beauty, but can come back and get us? What, in your experience, has ever worked in controlling some of the worst dimensions of advancing technology?
In terms of drones, I absolutely share your concern. You know, what is a drone? Well, a drone is just a computer, right? It's a computer that can fly, swim, crawl, or walk. And if you've gone online and watched some of the YouTube videos by Boston Dynamics, it is mind-blowing some of the capabilities of modern robots, both for good and for ill. The challenge is that the price of these drones has dropped tremendously. One of the very first unmanned drones was the Global Hawk, produced by the United States at about a cost of $3 billion. Now you can walk into a Tesco or a Costco or a Walmart and buy a drone for $100. So these are widespread, and if anything, the amount of growth in flying robots is going to increase exponentially. So I fear, and I've mentioned previously, you know, right now, people who grew up in this era and before have been able to look up into the sky and see stars and planets and the like. But the same way we have light pollution on the Earth, we're going to have drone pollution in the sky. There will be drones delivering packages. There will be drones transporting people. There will be drone taxis. And of course, because they're flying robots, which are flying computers, they too are hackable. And we know very little about the supply chain of the drones that are out there, except for this. The overwhelming majority of them are produced in China. And to answer your question about what we can do to control these, well, we saw that firsthand because the Ukrainians were using Chinese-made DJI drones and others to great effect in terms of uncovering and routing out Russian soldiers that had illegally invaded Ukraine. Well, DJI found out about that because the Russians complained to them. And then DJI restricted a whole bunch of navigational features on the Ukrainian DJI drones, or DJI drones from China, that were flying in Ukraine. So here the Ukrainians thought they have this great tool, but because of who manufactured it and the supply chain, of course, there were backdoors in them that the Chinese could exploit to down those drones as well. So it's quite a complicated question.
Mark, we started the show by saying this isn't science fiction, this is all real. But 10 years ago, when you wrote your piece, a lot of people thought it was science fiction. And now what you wrote and thought about has become real. As we look forward to the future of war, are we going to have soldiers? Are we going to have pilots? Or is it going to be lethal autonomous weapon systems that we see deployed that today looks to us like science fiction?
Absolutely. That is the future of warfare. In most countries around the world, drone and robotic warfare is not fully autonomous, meaning that there is always a human being in what's called the kill chain. It's not a very nice-sounding term, but it's accurate. So before a drone will take somebody out or shoot them or drop a bomb on them, for example, under the U.S. military code, there's always a human being that will interact in that. But there's no reason that has to be the case. And in countries, for example, like North Korea, they operate fully autonomous robots. The North Koreans operate fully autonomous robots in the DMZ. And if a movement is detected, the guns can just shoot automatically based on nothing more than the computer algorithm. And the challenge with that is, if I want to be more safe and more secure and more humane and ensure that my drones don't blow up anybody accidentally or injure the public unnecessarily and cause a humanitarian disaster, I will use a human in the loop. But if my human in the loop drone is going up against a fully automated drone that can react much more quickly than any human being can, then I will lose all of my drones and I will be outgunned in warfare. So I think, unfortunately, that the future of warfare is very autonomous. The challenge that we face with technology due to Moore's Law is that it proceeds at an exponential rate. It's constantly going up, 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 doubling, doubling, doubling. So that's what the technology does. But all of our systems of society are not exponential. They are, in fact, linear, completely flat. So there are all these systems are linear and completely flat. So if you think about business, government, public policy, law, ethics, they are struggling mightily to keep up what is technologically possible. And part of that problem is we don't have very many technologically savvy members of Congress in the U.S. The most common profession is that of lawyer. And we have a lot of senators in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. So we're going to have to change all of that.
Well, I don't want to, but we're going to have to leave it there. I could talk to you for hours on these issues and look forward to that in future shows. Mark Goodman, security advisor and former futurist in residence at the FBI and now chair of policy, law, and ethics at Singularity University. Really appreciate you scaring the heck out of us today. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Thank you, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? The president of Microsoft, Brad Smith, wrote an interesting book titled Tools and Weapons. In this book, he worries out loud that the technology designed to help societies improve, to increase productivity and achieve new heights, can also be used to harm us. Facial recognition software can make life a lot easier, but can also be used to spy on and essentially trap citizens. He and others point to how China tracks and enforces social controls on its population online and offline. Well, what can stop this dystopian future? Of course, science will keep pushing us forward and improving our health and our lives in every way imaginable. But the intersection of science and security is producing some very scary things. The only partial solution I can think of is exposing this, exposing the problems, talking about them until we all work together and establish guardrails that prevent tech from hurting you and hurting me. And that's the bottom line.